From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the second of two discussions about social conceptions of art and aesthetics. Following the conversation last week about architecture and American social values, the discussion at hand examines art and society in ancient Greece. My guest is Mary Sturgeon, an art historian and classical archaeologist from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Professor Sturgeon recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where she worked on a project that examines the sculptures from the sanctuary of Poseidon at Ismia, Greece. Here is Mary Sturgeon.
Of course, there are many differences between the way the Greeks would have seen their art and the way we see either our art or the art of the past. One of the major differences is that we see most art in a museum. Mm-hmm. We go there, we're taken as children by our parents, or we go in New York once a year when we happen to be on our way to Greece or whatever, and we go to the Metropolitan and everything is standing on a pedestal with a little label below it, and this is what we're used to, and this is the way we think of art being displayed by a museum board or something of that kind. Museums are not the oldest thing in the world. The first museums were not formed, and our first collections were not formed until the Roman period. If we're talking about the what we think of as the major periods of Greek art, the 6th through the 4th centuries, there were no museums. People did not have works of art in their houses. People did not go to public places which were designed purely for the display of art. But they saw art in an everyday context, in a very natural kind of context. The average Greek, who we think of as a rather politically interested figure, someone interested in philosophy and literature, someone who's rather outgoing and gregarious, would probably have gone to the major meeting place in his hometown or in the city in which he lived. Let's take Athens as the most familiar place to most of us. He would have gone to the marketplace, which we call the Agora, at least once during the day. And on his way through the Agora, he would have passed numerous statues. Many of these would be statues of deities. Some of them would be outside where everyone could see them. Others would be inside and would be worshipped as cult statues. He would have seen also statues of everyday people set up on monuments with maybe some kind of label down below, incised in stone, not the museum label that we think of nowadays.
Let me ask you what the purpose of all of this would have been in the sense of conscious artistic expression. Who were the artists, for instance, and did they think of themselves as having an audience?
That's a very interesting question. There are several interesting questions bound up in what you've just asked. The purposes of art in antiquity were very different from what they were today. Much of the purpose of ancient art was utilitarian, mm-hmm. which is not something we associate with art at all. And in fact, in Greece, you might say that the Greeks did not really have the distinction between fine art and craft the way we have. They had no word for art. They had one word that covered both areas, which is techne, from which we get our word technical. Uh-huh. So the artist really in antiquity, and I mean both Greece and classical Greece and Rome, was considered a craftsman. Some were better craftsmen than others, but the same word was used to be applied to both. So
What about the aesthetic sense behind all of this? I understand what you're getting at in the kind of the practical ability of the artist. Were there theories of art, for instance?
There certainly were theories about art written by artists mm-hmm. in the classical period, that is, in 5th century Athens. We know about this from reading ancient literature, that there is a certain limited or different concept of art from what we have nowadays, that you might substitute the word craft for art. Mm-hmm. And this raises a certain question. Were all ancient artists therefore viewed as craftsmen? And was there a distinction made between them which would not have been conveyed through a difference of word, but simply a different epithet or adjective, you know, the best craftsman or just the ordinary craftsman? Because the same term was used to be applied to The same term was used to apply to shoemakers as was used to apply to the man who made the Parthenon. So if the ancient Greek were to walk through the Stoa up and down, he would see displayed on the walls of the Stoa great monumental paintings, for instance. And these constructed in the 5th century BC, again, in the major period, or one of the high points, high periods of Greek artistic activity, he would see paintings that celebrate the Athenian victories in the Battle of Marathon against the Persians. He would see great mythological, several of these buildings around the Agora. One of them, in fact, was so famous in antiquity for its paintings that it was called simply the Painted Stoa. Mm-hmm. And it's this building, for instance, that has just recently been discovered, the foundations of the building, that is, by excavations done by the American School of Classical Studies in Athens.
Describe for me a Stoa in a little more detail.
A Stoa, yes. A Stoa is not a building that we have, mm-hmm. but we, in living in the South, might have great need of one. The Stoa, I think, is the ancient version of a modern mall, a covered walkway, which is designed to have shops along one wall and an open front facade mm-hmm. with columns. The reason there is a roof over the colonnade is so that you can escape from the heat of the sun in the summertime and the rains in the wintertime mm-hmm. and catch the cool breezes that come through. So it's a very practical kind of building, and it's a type of building that quite logically grew up in marketplaces in all cities mm-hmm. of the Greek East, the eastern part of the Mediterranean.
We've been talking about the general social purposes of art in antiquity. What would, let me just suggest a couple of possibilities. What would religion have to do with it? What would politics have to do with it? Was art in any fashion useful to the politicians and to the priests?
Well, we could write a whole book on, mm-hmm. on in answering that question. And that gets back to something we were talking about before. A great deal of the purpose of art in antiquity, and this is Greece, Rome, Egypt, and Mesopotamia, was utilitarian. Mm-hmm. And besides being at the same time as it was utilitarian, it also served religious ends. And religion was often used in a political sense.
Can you give me a specific example of how a religious or a political issue or event or personage, whatever, might have entered into the art of the ancient world?
Well, much of Greek art served religious purposes. That is, the statues that were made represented deities. These were set up in temples. The purpose of a temple is to house the cult statue. And so both in the two major artistic media, architecture and sculpture, a large portion of what was constructed in an artistic way was very directly religious. So you have the Parthenon being built on the Acropolis in order to house the cult statue of Athena Parthenos, which Phidias puts inside it. You also have other buildings on the Acropolis, which in its entirety is a sanctuary of Athena, other small temples which house smaller religious cults, which may also have had religious statuary in them. There were side buildings called treasuries put up to house the offerings that would be brought up on special feast days and presented to the deity. And then a very elaborate monumental gateway, which has a utilitarian purpose, a defensive and protective purpose, but which does not need to be elaborated, but which was in order to complete the overall design and to further enhance not only the sanctuary, but the city. And we have one of our historical sources for this period is the historian Thucydides, who writes in the last third of the 5th century about the war between Athens and Sparta, which we call the Peloponnesian War. And in comparing the two cities, he makes the very astute comment way back in his period that if people were to look at Athens physically as she stood around 430 and compare her with what they would see in the city of Sparta at the same time, they would have no idea that Sparta came anywhere near in political or historical importance to the city of Athens because of the tremendous contrast between the use of art and the use of architecture and sculpture and painting mm-hmm. in Athens, which the Spartans had no interest in whatsoever. And it's true, you go to visit the modern town of Sparta in southeastern Peloponnese, and one is at great pains to find remains that one can point to that can be dated to the 5th century. In antiquity, one would have seen art in more of an everyday context, I think. People would have seen it, as I said, on the way to the marketplace. They would have seen it as they went to the various religious sanctuaries. People in antiquity were religious, not in a modern sense, but they worshiped many gods, not just one god, but they paid attention to particular feast days and religious festivals. They were very concerned with doing the things you were supposed to do so you wouldn't get it in the back with an arrow someday from...
God'll get you, huh?
That's right, from Artemis or whatever.
Mary, I get the sense that art in the ancient world served far more of a unifying function, or was far more unified at social and political and economic and religious levels, or involving those dimensions, than it is today. Art today is what, kind of cubbyholed off, and as you said at the beginning of our conversation,
yes,
it's there in a museum,
mm-hmm.
and I don't get that sense at all from what you're
not
describing.
Not at all, not at all. It was not separated from life.
Mm-hmm.
It was very much a part of life, which is perhaps why the Greeks did not feel the need to have a separate word to apply to it.
In other words, these things weren't representations so much as they
were
embodiments.
These were the gods themselves.
Yeah.
These were the embodiments.
Mary, give me a specific example of an artist in the ancient world.
Well, perhaps the most famous of all ancient artists is the sculptor Phidias,
mm-hmm.
who worked in Athens at the time of when everything was going on that was exciting and fun to be a part of. And he was not only a part of it, he seems to have been the leader and the head of the most important or influential school. Phidias was the man who Pericles chose to head the entire building program of the Acropolis. And he was particularly concerned to oversee the construction of the Parthenon. He was not the architect. The architect was Ictinus, who may have worked with some other people. This means that Phidias had a tremendous job, and in a very short, relatively short period of time, 15 years, Parthenon was built between 447 and 432, with the great statue being dedicated in 438. So, and we know this from inscriptional records, which is unusual amount of information to have from this period in the past. So over this 15-year period, not only was the building completely put up without the benefit of any modern machinery, either for cutting the stones or for fitting them into place, but all the vast sculptural decoration of the building was designed and executed, and Phidias must have been in charge of that. The Parthenon, it's always hard to imagine, is one of the most elaborately decorated of any of the temples that were made ever in antiquity. It, first of all, the metopes, the square panels on the outside of the building, were decorated with high reliefs, which had a different subject on each of the four sides. Those which are the best preserved are the ones from the south side, which have the battle of the Greeks against the centaurs, and on the east, the battle of the gods against the giant. The second sequence to be composed was the Parthenon frieze, which is an Ionic frieze that strangely is placed on a Doric temple, but it was placed on the inside of the building, that is, on the outside of the main wall inside the colonnade, so it didn't conflict in interest with these outer panels that I've just mentioned. And the Parthenon frieze, of course, has as its subject the great Pan-Athenaic celebration, the coming of the Athenians, and particularly the youths and the maidens and the priestesses with their presents up to the Acropolis to present Athena with a glorious gift, which is what they did once every 4 years under ceremonies that were begun early on in the history of Athens and elaborated as time went on. Then the third sequence of sculptures were the over life size figures in the round carved to be placed on the pediments, and these in various ways celebrated Athens and glorified Athena also, who was the patron deity of the city of Athens, with on the east pediment the birth of Athena being displayed in the attendance of with all the gods and goddesses in attendance, and on the west end of the building the contest between Athena and Poseidon for the control of Athens as the titular deity.
Who did all of this work?
There must have been a large number mm-hmm. of craftsmen of various levels that, and here we get back to using the word craftsmen.
Yeah, and you say men. Were there no women involved in this at all?
I doubt it very much.
Just as a footnote here to our conversation.
No, right. The people doing the carving would have been men. They probably came from various cities of Greece because here was a great public works program. I always think of this as the first really successful WPA project, you know, which resulted in not bad stuff. Far cry from what we have on our post office walls, but I think in some ways the analogy is quite an interesting one. Now, we know from inscriptional record that people came from the Cycladic Islands, also from northern Greece, and they began to work together under this single man, Phidias, who may have chosen the subject matter, may have done some of the designs, but could not possibly have executed all these sculptures himself, and especially because he was the person in charge of designing and carrying out the cult statue on the inside, which was being made at the same time. So you have to imagine a very large group of people working together under a rather tightly knit kind of organization, which is hard for us to imagine having occurred in antiquity. It almost implies it would be difficult to do that kind of thing today without the benefit of modern computers and modern industrial techniques and modern technology. But this is one of the things that makes us appreciate the ancient technology so much, because it obviously was very sophisticated for mm-hmm. its time.
Mary, does Phidias have a modern counterpart? Is that an impossible kind of proposition?
Now, you're asking a classical art historian, and mm-hmm. my answer would be no. Mm-hmm. If you were to ask a contemporary art historian, you would get a different answer.
Who might be a candidate? I mean, my question is this. Has art itself changed so much? What he seems to have done would today involve so many disciplines and so many kinds of artistic expression. That all seems so unified, the function that this man seemed.
I think this is in general true of antiquity, that many disciplines were very often combined in the body of one person. You find that philosophers were also literary people and writers and statesmen and historians and sometimes generals if they had to pull together an army. And this is true in the artistic field as well. A sculptor might also have been a painter, and he may also have served in the army when that was needed. He did his time. He may also in his younger years have been active in sports. He may have gone to Olympia, the site of one of the four sites of Panhellenic Games, and run in some of the races there, and have had several victories before going on and writing poems to celebrate the victories of others, and this kind of thing. So I think that this is one thing that is easy to forget. We have become much more specialized and limited in many ways in both our interests and in our abilities to deal with a variety of situations, in contrast to what life was like in antiquity. Of course, the world has expanded a millionfold since then, and there's so many more areas to take into account that kind of almost Renaissance man, if you want to use that term, is hard to find. But I think that the educated Greek was very much a Renaissance man in that sense of the word as well.
Mary, tell me about what you're doing at the National Humanities Center.
The site that I'm working on is the sanctuary of Poseidon on the Isthmus of Corinth, called Isthmia. And it was very badly destroyed toward the end of antiquity. That is, people must have come through and wanted very particularly to destroy the statues standing around, which to them would be pagan, statues of pagan gods, pagan victors, people who were nude, which was a terrible thing, and temples to these foreign gods. And they were so destructive in their aims and their achievements that very little has survived whole, except for some pieces from the earliest periods which had been swept aside into a ancient rubbish pit, which we've been able to piece back together.
Well, Mary, what's the point of all of this? You're obviously
I've asked
not...
myself that many times while sitting in 120 degree heat in the cold, damp basement. Of
You're
the
not just
Museum.
Making a catalog, are you?
No, but you have to begin with that. You have to start with the evidence. You have to start with the facts. You have to figure out what the facts are. And the facts are contained in these mute pieces of stone, which I seem to be able to read, and which a lot of people are not particularly interested in even looking at. So I start with these. And when visitors come to my basement, I take them down and I show them that my little table of marble sherds, as I call them, as opposed to pot sherds. And I say that you wouldn't think to look at this display that this the person working on these things is an art historian, because it doesn't immediately present itself to you as works of lasting beauty or elevating idealism or any of the things which the artist Phidias, let's say, would have been concerned about, who we were just talking about. But one has to start with the facts. And so this is what I have done. And after pulling together the catalog, then I've come back to the calm, quiet, and both cooler and somewhat saner environment of the National Humanities Center, locked myself in my little office religiously every day, and have begun to sift through the evidence to see what kind of overall picture this would make up. People find fascinating the way in which small marble bits that don't look like anything come out of the ground, and the way I can point out details on them and get them to see what is actually there, and then show them a drawing or a comparison with a whole statue, and they will say, oh yes, oh that's what it was. I mean, there's something magical about dealing with fragmentary things that can be reconstructed into a whole picture.
Do you think of yourself as a detective? As
oh, absolutely.
A solver of puzzles?
Of course. Uh-huh. And my favorite reading, of course, is detective stories, detective fiction. This is what I usually pick up before I go away on vacation. It's the same kind of thing, only you have to imagine that working with archaeological sculpture, at least 90% of the pieces are missing. I've always thought it would be fun to make a sort of Parker House game, you know, and withhold an archaeological puzzle and withhold 40% of the pieces, which would be completely white with no jigsaw puzzle with no marks on it, you know. Very frustrating, and must be done only at extreme temperatures or with extreme physical discomfort so that people can see with the glamour of archaeology, because it is a lot less than initially meets the eye, I think.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the second of two discussions about social conceptions of art and aesthetics. My guest was Mary Sturgeon, a professor of art history and classical archaeology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Professor Sturgeon recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where she worked on a project that examines the sculptures from the Sanctuary of Poseidon at Ismia, Greece. Soundings on Art and Society concludes now with a commentary by a recent visitor to the National Humanities Center. Here is Elaine Cohen, a professional sculptor who lives in Stony Brook, New York.
I should like to respond to a recent statement by a director of an art museum, prompted by his comment that he sees education as an important function of the museum. One can hardly disagree with that. However, museum going, seen as a pleasurable as well as an educational activity, not mutually exclusive, requires preparation. One needs to learn how to look at art these days, to develop what I like to call aesthetic readiness. By this, I mean an awareness of line, texture, mass, color, as well as the ability to relax and enjoy them. Children who are exposed to good education in art, which includes both looking and making, are the potential museum patrons of the future. If museums are to flourish, if they are to be more than elegant storage bins for artifacts, both museum personnel and the public in general must be concerned about the training of these youngsters. Therefore, they must address themselves to the current situation in which art is disappearing from many schools as a result of current budgetary strains. At present, many adults who determine school curricula in American schools regard art as a dispensable frill. They may agree that it's a pleasing activity for some students, and that art products are occasionally worthy of respect, but the predominant judgment can be stated simply: pleasant, but not really very important. There are, of course, exceptions, but basically, our society puts a low value on aesthetic experiences, including those provided by museums. And most schools and homes reflect these societal attitudes. I believe that both children and adults are being cheated as a result of this misconception. Symbolic representations of the world through pictures and sculptures are as natural to human beings as the development of speech. In fact, children's understanding and use of visual symbols frequently precedes speech and always precedes written language. Children relish art not only for its symbolic value, but also for the aesthetic pleasure that they derive from the use of art materials. Simultaneous learnings which take place in the course of the art process are very important. These are learning to think, learning to see, learning about feelings and about themselves. And all of these learnings are basic to good education. In the art process, one subjects the disorder of life to an orderly arrangement, separating the important from the unimportant. Now, this satisfies basic human needs, as well as providing the pleasure of sensory experiences. To me, art is essentially a quest for order. Perhaps as children and adults begin to understand this, they might consider more thoughtfully the possibilities of ordering their own selves and even perhaps their environment. The public must speak up for art in the schools. Through sensitive education in art, we can try to reach the minds and emotions of children in the nonverbal way that is unique to the arts. We can help them to grow up to be individuals with discrimination and taste. Familiarity with art can help them to enjoy and develop a sense of wonder at the extraordinary diversity of the human mind as exhibited in the art objects that have been produced over the centuries. Well, that is a big order, you may protest. Perhaps. But art is a big subject, and it's the very richness of the subject that suggests such a diverse potential. We may not know all of the skills needed to utilize art to the utmost, but we do know a good many of them. One thing is sure, if the arts are eliminated from the schools, we shall never even have a chance to try.
Elaine Cohen is a professional sculptor from Stony Brook, New York. You've been listening to the second of two discussions about social conceptions of art and aesthetics. The program is Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me for the concluding segment in the Soundings series on social conceptions of art and aesthetics. My guest this week is Mary Sturgeon, a professor of art history and classical archaeology from the University of North Carolina. To what extent do ancient notions of art and aesthetics have modern counterparts? What were the popular and specialized purposes of art in ancient Greece? How did these purposes parallel or diverge from classical Greek conceptions of artistic theory and practice? Social Aesthetics, Part 2, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.